The State of the Union is strong, but we're keeping an eye on Virginia. From Fox News Radio, I'm the woman who made queso.
And I'm Chris Steierwalt.
And this is Perino and Steierwalt. I'll tell you what.
I'll tell you what. That is full redemption from last week. That is funny.
Thank you. Made it
that
up right here.
That is funny.
I mean,
that
they gave me funny. A head start. They gave me a head start. They gave me a head start. They did.
Keeping an eye on the old Commonwealth of Virginia down there that is just so eager to melt down.
Why don't we talk about Virginia first, and then we'll get to the State of the Union and queso. And oh, we didn't do mailbag.
Well, it was not
my turn.
It was not my mailbag.
Okay, wait, you talk about what you think about Virginia, and I got to reach over for my phone. Okay, goodbye.
Okay.
I mean, I'll be right back.
So, to keep it simple, just so that as we record this, because obviously the situation is subject to change, but just in a very quick recap, on Friday, Governor Ralph Northam is found to have on his yearbook page from medical school from 1984, there is a picture of somebody dressed as a Klansman and somebody in blackface. He says, "I'm sorry." And it was heartless and thoughtless. And then he said, "Wait, actually, it wasn't me and I didn't do the page. But before I conclude, that same year I did wear blackface in order to participate in, of all things, a dance contest in San Antonio, Texas." This is followed by the excited rise of Justin Fairfax, the Commonwealth's lieutenant governor, a rising star, African-American, telegenic, and really somebody on whom Virginia Democrats had placed a lot of hopes for the future, that he had been accused by a woman in relation to a 2004 encounter at the Democratic National Convention. The accusation was posted by a sketchy site. And it had been posted, and then he said this had been brought up. The Washington Post addressed this. They found this woman was red flags, and he goes out and starts trying to smear the accuser. They even share a video where she's talking about that she had been the victim of other sexual offenses, and you try to say as evidence, well, she didn't mention it here, so she must be making this up. And even intimated that somehow Ralph Northam had been involved in this. So then the Washington Post says, no, that's not what we said. And then the woman came forward and with today a heartbreaking sounding story that, you know, and she reveals herself. She's a professor. She's an accomplished woman. She is whether or not the accusation is deemed credible, she is a credible human, it would seem. And it basically makes the strongest possible Me Too case here, which is to say you denied it, you smeared me as the accuser and basically said I was crazy so that you could move on to your next great goal as a male politician. While that is all unraveling, the attorney general of the state, Mark Herring, a liberal white Democrat from liberal white Democrat Northern Virginia, the guy who would be next in the line of succession to the governorship, says, by the way, in 1980, when I was a student, I think probably a freshman at the University of Virginia, that he and his friends dressed up as Curtis Blow and his band. And by the way, shout out to Curtis Blow. This is a strange way to get back in the news, but Curtis Blow, whose great song "The Breaks" and others, but that they did a performance at a party as Curtis Blow and his band, and that he wore blackface and a wig for those purposes. And now the Virginia Democratic Party has officially cratered, has officially exploded into atoms, and is strewn across the face of the earth.
It is crazy. I had Jesse Jackson on the show just before we recorded this podcast.
Look at you.
Oh, did you not know that?
I was busy writing. I did not see that you
had Reverend
Jackson. I
have a most excellent booker on my show.
Quite so. True fact.
I asked him, I said, let's just start off. Like, can you explain to people why this is offensive? Just make sure everybody understands why blackface is offensive. Please, just once and for all, can we just get this understood? He did a pretty good job of explaining it.
Well,
but the thing is, he had called for Northam to resign in an op-ed over the weekend. And I said, well, should Mark Herring not be able to serve now? Because he just did the same thing. And then people are looking through. I found this to be true as well today, especially on campuses. This is still common.
Sure.
And I don't think people realize that.
Well, look, we can take it separately or we can take it as a piece. I think that as a piece, all three things are part of one other thing. And you and I talked about this on TV a little bit. But the truth of the matter is that we, especially for Blue America, that there is a civic religion. It is a non-theistic civic religion that has as its mainstays anti-racism and feminism, and that these are considered, I guess you can put income inequality in there too, but these two are really animating principles of this secular faith and sort of what we're here for. And when you saw this, when you have seen this deployed in the past, a great example, Al Franken, it was a dubious case, but it was not an open and shut case. This was not like other Me Too stories in which a gross offense that mm-hmm. has taken place that is actually a crime and all of this other stuff. There was more margin here, but Democrats drummed him out, and it was quite transparent. With Kristen Gillibrand leading the charge, it was quite transparent that the purpose here, the idea here was that if they did not punish him, they would not be able to punish Roy Moore and Republicans. They needed to do this so as not to be seen as hypocritical.
Right.
And Al Franken had to be sacrificed at this altar in order to maintain the purity. And I would only submit that we have gotten to a point now where for the adherence to this secular faith, the process of it, the pieties of it are more important than the object. So I would think that every American of good heart and good faith believes that racism is real, it is pernicious, and it is to be decried, and it is to be avoided. Any time that a person, any of our fellow Americans, is deprived of something because of their race, ethnicity, gender, this is against our creed. This is against who we are, and it should be avoided. But then you get to the point where it's sort of religiosity. Mark Herring is a liberal Democrat. He is not a Ralph Northam moderate-ish Southern kind of Democrat. He's a liberal white Democrat from a liberal white Democrat part of the state who has a track record that in no way, and you can say the same thing of Northam. Not only does he have a track record that shows that he is not racist, but he has a track record that shows him affirmatively, in a very progressive manner, pushing in the other direction. Must he also be ruined? Must he also be destroyed because of something that he did when he was 18? And sort of the madness of it starts to become evident.
Yep.
It's a doozy.
They've made a certain bed that they're lying in.
That's right. And also, by the way, the Me Too case against Justin Fairfax and Justin Fairfax's response to it, it exceeds that against Brett Kavanaugh. Now, look, the office that Brett Kavanaugh was pursuing was more substantial even than the governor of the Commonwealth and, of course, deals with many, many, many millions more humans and affects more lives. But the offense, if I am not a lady. However, my understanding is that the object of the Me Too movement was so that in situations exactly like this, precisely like this, where you have a he said, she said, that the woman is to be treated credibly, that she is to be heard, that she is supposed to be treated with respect in this process, and also things like didn't report it immediately and all these other things are not supposed to be held against her so that the facts of the matter can be pursued. The way Fairfax responded to this was purely retrograde. Purely retrograde. She's crazy. It was no different. I shouldn't say no different, but it was little different than what the Clintons did to the people who accused Bill Clinton of his improprieties, that you make them out to be crazy, that you make them out to be crooked, that you make them out to be this wrong thing, instead of saying, okay, let's have a fair hearing and let's talk about this.
Well, also, though, think about the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Who had heard about these allegations a year or so ago, Said they checked him out, didn't run with them. But they didn't do the same for Brett Kavanaugh.
Yes. I first would say on the question...
As an editor,
I am certainly sympathetic and probably supportive. I can't know everything, but probably supportive of the post choice in the Fairfax story, because what they did the correct thing. We have a story. Two people agree. They entered the room together.
Mm-hmm.
No one disagrees that she volitionally went with him into his hotel room. But we have a very different story about what transpired thereafter. And so they did the correct thing, which is if we publish this accusation, it will destroy him. He will be ruined by this accusation. And so they went and looked. Is there anything in his life or career that would seem to indicate this is this kind of person, right? Did he have settlements? Did he have near misses? Did he have problems? Were there other things that said this might be a pattern of behavior? Because very often with people who commit sex crimes, they are not independent activities. These are part of a pattern. So for the Post, I understand and support their choice. With Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, I agree with you, and I hear why the unfairness of it is evident. But I would also say the malefactor in the Christine Blasey Ford story is really Dianne Feinstein, because she set in motion with a letter of basically saying there's somebody out here, and I don't I hope someone leaks this thing. That I hope some reporter finds this thing. And in the end, it was Ford who went to the Post. And I suspect that if the accuser, if Fairfax's accuser had done what Blasey Ford did and gone to the Post and said, I will sit for an interview. You can identify me by name. This is me. And I'm going to sit here and tell my story and let the consequences fall where they may. I think it would have probably been very different.
Well, maybe. Well, we'll see what happens over there. Because, as you were pointing out, they're in their line of succession in the state's constitution, you could end up with a Republican governor of Virginia.
Well, and now Northam's making some noise. It sounds like that he might become an independent. And this is like now Democrats.
Oh, shut up. Honestly.
No. Check it out. And it's an interesting play for Northam, who is, other than his position on what happens to babies after they're born. That sounds like an odd preamble. But other than his position on abortion, is quite a moderate Democrat, a business-friendly sort of Southern Democrat kind of guy, moderate. If he really did leave the Democratic Party, he can make a credible threat to Democrats. Oh, you don't want me? I'm out? Well, there's very small majorities in the House of Burgesses and in the Senate, but they're both Republican, and if he became an independent and took his half out of the middle, he could do plenty of pain
to Democrats. But how many people could he take with him?
Well, it wouldn't be about how many people he could take with him. It would be that he could help Republicans achieve their legislative aims, and basically being a curious independent willing to work with the House and the Senate on legislation, they could actually enact stuff that undoes the Democratic policy agenda. And instead of him being there to veto stuff, he might be there to sign it and work with him. And so Democrats are now considering this sort of a catalog of horribles that would have been unimaginable just 6 months ago.
That's crazy town. Anyway.
Crazy town.
Okay, so we'll see what happened there. Let's talk about State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
So I had three areas I wanted to talk about. The themes of the speech, the mm-hmm. policies of the speech,
mm-hmm.
and the stories within the speech. I guess mm-hmm. there's four things, actually. And then the reaction to the speech, setting mm-hmm. aside Republicans, right? They were on their feet 40 times. They interrupted with applause 102 times. Just setting that aside. They loved it. I had the brain room look up something for me today because I thought you would appreciate a little historical note.
Mm.
In the chamber last night was the highest number of presidential candidate hopefuls than in any other time.
I bet that's right.
Still count a couple of others that haven't announced it, like Michael Bennett. But anyway.
Michael Bennett. I don't think Michael Bennett's going to inflict that on himself or the nation.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to do that, though. He wanted to take on Ted Cruz the other day. But that was just because of the shutdown. What did you think of the Democrats' reaction to the speech?
I give everybody an A.
Okay.
A's across the board. That was normal. People were not jerks. It was fine. Trump gave, I thought, I particularly liked the interplay between the Democrats and Trump on when they were trying to face him when he was talking about women and jobs, and they'd stand up like, yeah, that's us. We got the jobs, Donald Trump. And then he goes, wait, you're going to like this even more.
I know, that was good.
and then tells him, like, and you. And you got to, if you can get a USA chant, a bipartisan USA chant going on the floor of the House during the State
and
of the Union.
And a happy birthday.
A happy birthday.
To an 81-year-old. Aww.
Yeah. I mean, just so I give everybody an A.
Okay,
we got through that hideous institution. No one was harmed. Nothing bad had to happen. There were not outrages.
It was long, though.
Oh, my gosh, it was long.
Remember when everybody used to make fun of Clinton for his long speeches? But no one makes fun of Trump.
Clinton still got the title. I believe his 2000 State of the Union.
Yeah.
But Trump will catch him next year. Trump will catch him next year. He loves it, right? He's like a dog getting a belly rub.
And, you know, I was reading along because I was doing the coverage.
With Nancy Pelosi, who was reading along in the back.
Oh, my God. That was a little weird.
That was her crutch so that she wouldn't be pulling too many faces.
Yeah. Although I have to say, when we were on page 4 and we were only 40 minutes in and there were 14 pages total, I was like, wow.
I was feeling for y'all back on set. Woo! I was sitting in Bill Salmon's office and we were drinking Diet Cokes and enjoying ourselves, or Coke Zero and enjoying ourselves, and thinking about you poor people trapped in the ice box back there waiting to apply.
It wasn't that cold.
Oh, good.
By the way, I imagine that you would love some of the stories that were told, especially the historical references of the Greatest Generation. That was pretty neat.
Oh, yeah. Well, I also think that in our, speaking of civic religion, who you choose as your heroes matters a lot. And I think that for all that was said and all that was done about the Greatest Generation and what Tom Brokaw wrote and all of those things, I think preserving that as sort of if the greatest accomplishment of an American is to selflessly risk his own life to save the lives of others, of strangers, a world away, people of a different faith, of a different background, of a different thing, that Americans risk their lives to save the lives of others, that's a pretty good thing to celebrate.
Hear, hear.
That's a pretty good thing to celebrate.
Something I liked in the speech was a line that he used, that we need to define a new standard of living for the 21st century.
Okay.
I like that. Because I felt like it was a bigger theme of going forward, even though we're a fifth of the way into the century. But I liked it because I was like, you know what? Of all the things that we read about, the concerns about AI, the technological revolution, how are people going to work, universal base insurance, how are we going to blah, 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 all the economic stuff that is floating around out there. I felt like that was a good umbrella way to talk about it. And then he just dropped it.
Well, because it's
there was no follow through, but I'm like, but that's great.
But also, people in hell want ice water, and if a frog had wings, it wouldn't bump its bottom when it hopped. Those things, the bridge to the 21st century, the grandiosities of these speeches that you tack them in, where it's like, we need a little lift off here, we need a little VTOL.
Yes, I know, but sometimes you can use that for all your other stuff. Like it becomes like the umbrella theme across. Like, for example, the freedom agenda.
Right.
Okay. Like that, if you think about the second inaugural speech of George W. Bush, that was the freedom agenda. And everything that we did, and you look through the prism of,
right,
does this match the freedom? Does this fall under the freedom agenda? Are we moving forward on the mission?
So to me, what
President Trump is talking about, and I think this makes a lot of sense, I don't think it's just going into the next congressional cycle. It's going into his reelection and the future. Like that seemed to me, it was a great line, and maybe they'll go back to it.
So the reelection stuff. Well, so first on the question of a new standard of prosperity. What did he say? A new standard of prosperity?
Of living.
A new standard of living. dangerous. But also when governments try to engineer those things, they fail and make people miserable.
Well, I don't think he was saying that. The government was going to engineer.
Well, here's what we need is we have, as I always say, cultural type 2 diabetes. We are so sick from our wealth. We are so sick from our prosperity. We are so sick from being rich that we have manufactured problems for ourselves. We have made ourselves sick with social media. We have made ourselves sick with excess. And what we need is a return to virtue because we are rich but unhappy. And happiness is not a purpose in life. Doing good, doing right, serving your fellow man, loving your neighbor as yourself, that is a good purpose in life. But happiness is a better standard than wealth, right? Are you happy? Are you content? Does your life bring you those things? Now, based on the tradition that I follow, the way that you achieve real happiness, real and lasting happiness, is to do for other people and to be of service. That's where the greatest happiness comes, a life of purpose. But measuring whether or not you're rich doesn't tell whether or not you're happy. And as we get to a point, you know, we always talk about the dystopian future in which, you know, robots rule the world and we are, you know, we are harvested for our corneas or whatever. That's all fine. But there's another possibility that we ought to think about, which is that we might be happy, that we might be prosperous. And, you know, people talk about sort of a post-scarcity world in which we have technology has advanced to such a point that we no longer have to worry about scarcity, that we no longer have to worry about those same things that have driven us these many thousands of years. And I'm not saying that that's the most likely outcome, but I am saying we ought to think about the possibility that purpose and happiness could be what animate our activities rather than just getting enough to get by.
What did you think of the border stuff? I'll tell you, that's where I thought the speech really bogged down, because he was saying the same things. He's preaching to the converted, and there were so many statistics. I remember from eighth grade, from Mrs. Sammy Wheeler.
Hit it.
From speech class, you don't want to have too many statistics, and people start thinking you're in math class.
Well, I think
that's how I felt. I was like, whoa, and there's this, and they're expert. And I just felt like it was the same thing, and it went on. As I was following along, it was like almost three pages.
I think the three things that – so the Trump is going to go have a rally in El Paso.
Yeah,
he's going to have a campaign rally.
What do you think about that location?
Well, that's because he wants to talk about the wall. He wants to talk about the border fence. But I would say this. The three things you're going to hear a lot from Trump about that he was exploring 2020 reelection themes. Number one, socialism. You're going to hear a lot about socialism. You're going to hear a lot about him saying Democrats are socialists. That's number one. Number two, you're going to hear about immigrants, murder, unsafe. The Democrats want open borders. And then the third one, which sort of surprised me, but I think is politically astute, is abortion. And and those were the three that I don't think Donald Trump is going to run a positive campaign in 2020. And I think what he is going to do is as a relatively unpopular incumbent, he is going to say, this is what these people want. They want infanticide, socialism, and open borders from crime, or crime from open borders. That's that your other choice is carnage. Your other choice is the slaughter of innocents. Your other choice is open borders. Your other choice is socialism. And I think that what I heard when he hit those three things, I think that will be those will be the mainstays of his campaign.
I think so too. I think so too.
But happiness could be, maybe he'll change his mind and do happiness.
But does happiness get you out of the house to vote?
No, it does not. It does not.
You're going to make so much fun of me right now, but it just because, look, did you know, okay, there is a woman running for president. She's declared. I believe she's declared.
Mm-hmm.
New Age guru, Marianne Williamson.
Yeah.
You familiar?
Yeah.
So I read her book, A Return to Love, when I was in college. And I was going through like a bad time.
Okay.
And I read that book, and I felt like it really helped me.
Okay.
See things in a better way.
Yeah.
And
you never know. You never know.
Because the book is not just about like being new age. Like you could apply those principles to Christianity or however you grew up.
Sure. Ice your own cupcake.
What?
It's a term refers to you start with the cupcake in the case you're describing Christianity, and then you can put some extra toppings on there.
Oh,
you can ice your own.
Yeah,
you
okay, so I did
cupcake.
That. I did that. Yeah. Right. I remember one time I came home from college. I think I was a freshman, maybe a sophomore. I came home from college for Thanksgiving, and I don't know what I was taking a philosophy class. And I told my dad at dinner that I was thinking of becoming a Buddhist. This was not a good memory, really.
Oh.
I just remember, like, that was, wow. I just remember that.
Oh,
but anyway, I'm not a Buddhist.
Every parent's nightmare.
There's worse things you can be than a Buddhist. They're pretty peaceful people.
They are peaceful people. That's true. It's true. It's true what you say, but every Western Christian parent's nightmare. I sent our little darling daughter away to college to learn about the things, and then she came back and said, "I'm thinking about going to an ashram and studying the ways of the Buddha." And it's like, no.
Oh, but you know what? I do kind of have a fantasy about that, though. Like, that would be a great sabbatical.
Well,
and I think I might want to take that sabbatical around June 2020.
Yep. Seems like a good time. And then just check back
in
November.
I just want to come back in October.
Yeah,
for the home stretch.
No, check back in after the election and say, "Okay, how'd you do?
How's everybody?
How did everybody
anyway,
do?"
Anyway, I listened to her soulful conversation with Oprah that was recorded a year or two ago.
Uh-huh.
Before any presidential stuff was talked about. And they talked about happiness and love and kindness. And then there was this part at the end talking about like the environment and stuff. I just fast forwarded through that, but because I'm a heathen and not quite a Buddhist, I guess. I don't know. Why did I just bring that up? Oh, because you were talking about happiness.
You're a coal-fired Buddhist, which is very rare. You don't see a lot of the coal-fired Buddhists out there, but you could be one.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Man.
Can I tell you that the Amy Klobuchar candidacy.
Oh, I had. Oh, I'm going to cross her off my list now because you just brought her up.
Bringing it up. The Amy Klobuchar candidacy. I'm sort of figuring out the lanes, who's running against who, where does somebody fit. And by the way, Democrats just have they no decency? Like, they just keep jumping in.
Yeah, they're about to get smashed too early, too.
Well, but the other thing is no restraint. It seems like it's wide open, but the truth is the longer it takes them to do this, the harder it's going to be for them to get real, for them to beat Trump. But I watched the totally stagey reaction of Kristen Gillibrand,
mm-hmm.
where it was like this very forced eye roll.
And then to do a fundraising appeal afterwards. Ugh.
It's so canned.
Wow,
so
if I could raise money off of eye rolls, I'd be billionaire.
Oh, you would be. Yeah, exactly. You would be able to buy an island and build an ashram. It was so corny and so stagey and so on brand for her, right? On brand for Gillibrand are these wincy moments.
Yes, but also, do you follow them on Twitter at all?
Who?
Gillibrand?
The candidates?
Yeah,
yeah.
The candidates. Did you see, I really do adore Meredith Kelly, who is her spokesperson who they hired.
Mm-hmm.
But there's these tweets of her out on the road where she's having a great time out on her road trip, and she's eating Twizzlers, and it's a great road trip. And then they're sledding down the hill, and it's like fun. And I'm like, I'm not buying any of this.
Well, but I would just contrast that with Kamala Harris,
mm-hmm.
whose reaction gif was solid gold, was a pure gold. I think she was sitting
I don't think
next
I saw
to.
It.
Oh, I'll send it to you. it just perfectly because it's she like I don't know whether she says whatever or what like she but she mouths some word, but she, it's a slow like head nodding, like the chin drag, like duh. And I think she's saying something to Sherrod Brown, and it seems normal, and it went viral by itself. Her office wasn't saying, chip in $5 to support more eye roll gifts. It happened on its own. And you can just – the frustration, I think, for a lot of these candidates is either you got it or you don't got it. And it's really hard to not have it. It's really painful. You think about this. The office of the presidency with the powers of a monarch limited only by time, that we do this. We have this office, and it is not – a meritocracy. And when you look at people like Gillibrand or you look at people like Klobuchar, and it's like, well, I meet the standards. I should, this is where I should be. This is what I should be doing. It's like, yeah, but nah. And as the Republicans went through in 2016, the it's my turn or this is right for me or I'm supposed to be doing this, the Democratic Party is responding very well to Harris. Very mm-hmm. well to Harris. And mm-hmm. there is a strong, you can see it out there. You can feel it out there. There's a, like, they're liking what they're seeing. And she seems very comfortable. This and when you think about how hard this is and you have lived next to it in your life, how what an unusual space it is in life to say, okay, everyone is going to watch everything that you do around the clock and mm-hmm. judge you constantly for it. Mm-hmm. You will be constantly scrutinized and judged even for the look on your face. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to stare at you for a year and wait for you to make mistakes and criticize you for it. It takes a certain kind of person, maybe a lunatic, I don't know. It takes a certain kind of person to be willing to do it and then a certain skill set to get through it. And so far, Harris is the only one that I have seen that seems like she may have that in her because it's a weird, very specific skill set.
I want to know at what point does one of those Democrats take a shot at Elizabeth Warren over her?
Oh, she's done.
Continued problems with her.
She is
checking the
she
boxes is, that she's American
she
Indian
done.
Native American. You think she's done?
Well, look.
But does she know she's done?
Well, now this is where the Democrats really get into trouble. Who's going to force her out of the race? She's
yeah, that's
money.
What I want to know. Who's going after her first? I think it's Booker.
I don't think Booker's going to take her out. I think Booker has some pretty bad instincts, as he demonstrated in his lambasting of the
Naomi Rao.
Woof. Like,
yeah, so
woof.
she's the president. We're going to Starwalt this thing, but we're going to fix
okay.
that.
Okay.
Naomi Rao is a lawyer, and the president
for the administration. Yes.
Yes, and she does all the OIRA is the term, Office of Something and Regulation something.
Right. It's internal oversight, basically.
Right.
For
regulations, things like that.
Right.
And so she's been nominated by President Trump to take over her Brett Kavanaugh seat on the D.C. Circuit, and she's having, you know, the Democrats are trying to block her from getting that position because she is also then they're worried, oh, but then they'd have a woman of color who could be on the Supreme Court and we can't have that. So
right.
He is talking very much like this.
Very much.
As Gutfeld said, that it's like he's eaten something really hot. So he's
yes.
Like, hot pizza. Anyway, so he says, oh, well, have you ever had any law clerks from the LGBT community? And she's like, well, I've yet to be a judge.
A judge. So I don't have any law
yeah,
clerks.
So like, oh, that was so funny, though.
It was very funny. So Booker is got some he has some bad
instincts.
So
do you think that Gillibrand is going to try to take Warren out?
Well, Gillibrand, I think what Gillibrand did to Al Franken. And did it in a very transactional way, basically, to say we have to garrote Al Franken in order for our larger political ambitions to advance. I mean, she would do a lot of things. She is obviously a political knife fighter, and I'm sure that is within her. But I would say this. That's not who she's fighting. It's Bernie Sanders who Warren is actually fighting. When we think about it, so Klobuchar's drawing to Iowa. She's looking at Iowa. I'm from Minnesota. I'm Midwestern. I can do Iowa. I can catch on in Iowa, and I can win there, and that can be what I do. But Sanders and Warren are looking at both Iowa and New Hampshire, but particularly New Hampshire, to say liberal, white, old, Northeast, we match. This is their dating profiles match. And there you go. I don't know that it's going to be Gillibrand, who is sort of running. The rationale for her candidacy has yet to be explained to me by anybody, that somehow Democrats are looking for a Wall Street friendly. I don't get where that mojo is, but I think Warren might persist sort of in a her candidacy might persist in a vegetative state permanently. She might continue. She's got money. She's got resources. And she has high name identification, and she no doubt can continue to claim 5% or 8% of the vote and keep going along. But I will tell you that her choice to downplay and diminish what she did in trying to extract the benefits from Native American status, her choice to, oh, well, it was not a thing. I never used it. They were basically, her narrative was, they were pestering me to join the group at Harvard, and I did because I wanted to make friends and be social, but it wasn't anything that I ever used, and I would never do that. To have this come out, and the way that, by the way, talking about media criticism, which I loathe, but the Washington Post buried the lead. I have seldom seen a lead so deeply buried as the Washington Post, which headlines a story, Elizabeth Warren apologizes to Native groups, and then nine paragraphs down. By the way, in a FOIA request, we found out that she had in her own hand described herself as American Indian on her Texas State Bar application long before any of those other things happened. And it's just when you've been caught out on this, she's now been caught out on this three times, mm-hmm. and now says, no, now I'm good. Starting now, it's like Ralph Northam. You only get really one shot, but you definitely don't get three shots to try to clean it up. And she's not good at this.
And, you know, we haven't talked since I had Howard Schultz on the show.
Yeah, we did. We talked on the same day.
Oh, we did. But you know what? I did the interview and then I came here, but we hadn't talked about the interview that ran.
Oh, right.
But also,
about the things that didn't run.
Right. But setting that aside.
Yes.
So he's had a week out there in the world of
very successful.
You think a successful week?
Very much so.
Okay, tell me a little bit more.
Well, I thought he really hit his stride. You gave him the business, as is your job. But I thought he did very well in his interview with you. And I think that the idea of a boring normal person. who is not from some bizarro world in which politics is the all-consuming hell that eats our lives. The best pitch that Howard Schultz could make to the American people running as an independent was, I promise if you elect me president, you won't have to hear from me or about me every day. I will not be in your face. I will go do my job. And when big and important things happen, I will talk to you about it. I will tell you about it. But I will not be you will not be living in a terrarium where you are choked by the scent of me every moment, which is what the presidency has become. And it became certainly under Obama and intensified under Trump every day, every minute of every day. Well, we're talking about this one person out of 325 million. It's all out of proportion. I also think that Schultz's decision to do his policy kickoff this week in Indiana at Purdue University, where Mitch Daniels is president, a guy who Schultz has praised before. Now, Mitch Daniels is a very conservative human. If you read his book, Keeping the Republic,
best defense of conservatism out there.
Really good. Mm-hmm. A really well done. And Mitch Daniels is a very conservative person, but he's also a very pragmatic person who does not want to let the perfect get in the way of the good. If we can achieve some things, and his track record as governor of Indiana showed this clearly, if we can achieve 80% of the things that we want, let's not do zero just because it's not 100. And Schultz has praised him and talked about him. If what Schultz is really going to do is try to take his half out of the middle, and start to go for disaffected Trump voters. I think Democrats are making a we lived through this in 2016. No vote belongs to anyone. And it's not, well, if you're voting for this person, then you vote blah, blah, blah. All of these, the weird math. If Schultz really came along and said, yeah, when I say that I'm fiscally conservative, what I mean is I'm pragmatic. I want to get to what works. I want to figure out the things that work. And I want to do things so that we don't just keep going around and around and around. Because the big knock on Trump is going to be from Democrats. It's just chaos and scandal and partisanship, and nothing ever happens. They never get anything. They don't do things. They just fight, and they just fight. And we're going to get things done. We're going to get America
back
on
track. But
don't
you think that in some ways, like, and I didn't have enough time with him to really dig into this because we were talking a little bit more about his book. He has actually very liberal policy mindset.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Especially on what the role, scope, size, and shape of government should be. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. that's true, and I think on social issues, he's liberal.
I do kind of like it with how he pushed back against Elizabeth Warren, though.
Yes, and dealt with.
He's like, I did this on my own, and he doesn't mean it in the way that like Obama's like, oh really? Because everybody helped you. And did you see the left come after him that way?
Oh yeah.
You grew up in the projects, which means that you had help. And he's like, no, I didn't say I didn't have that. It's hard to tell people read the book, but I actually think that people read the book, they would understand more.
I won't broad stroke the left on that one, but there were definitely individuals who tried to mount that attack on Schultz, and it's a dumb one because it allows him, of course, to reinforce the attractive part of his biography. Whereas Donald Trump was, we now know, the beneficiary of enormous help from his father, the stunning amount of money that flowed to Donald Trump from his father's great success, mm-hmm. That this is a guy who really did it. This is really a guy who was born in the projects and really did it. And that's appealing to people because it makes them think, maybe he understands me, maybe he cares about me. Because I will promise you, the person who wins the 2020 election, unless events intervene and things get really weird and scary, the person who wins the 2020 election is the person who can win on the question of cares about people like mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. Who cares about people like me? Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. managed to convince Americans that she was running for president for herself. I'm with her. Not I'm with you, but in fact, I'm with her.
Right.
And she managed to convince Americans that she was not in it for them, but in fact that they were here for her. And that's death.
Have you been having fun watching all the commentary about all the different logos as the presidential candidates announce? I think it's hilarious.
I have. And
very funny.
I love the memes that Klobuchar created with her thing.
The Geico commercial.
The Geico commercial. I stopped smoking with Chantix.
So good.
So good.
Okay, so I did mailbag. Here's a question. It's not really a question, but it's something that happened during the Howard Schultz interview, so I thought I'd mention it. His name is Pi, says, I understand what Schultz felt in regard to his dad being in World War II and not being able to discuss the war. I think my dad might have PTSD. Not sure. And this is in regard to the question of him not being able to forgive his dad for decades after a pretty rough childhood. He calls it a fraught childhood.
Yeah.
And then when he was working with wounded warriors later on with Starbucks, he learns about the invisible wounds of war and PTSD, and it occurs to him, aha, I think that's what was going on with my dad. And that's a part of that.
It is so hard to forgive the people we love who betray us. This is the hardest part.
Marianne Williamson talks about that in the podcast.
Well, you know
actually,
who else talked about
it? It's a big part of the podcast, actually.
Do you know who else talked about that?
Jesus.
Jesus of Nazareth. he also has a bestseller. And the idea that the most important person to forgive is that person who hurt you so deeply and violated your trust and did that. Now, that doesn't mean you have to trust him again. That doesn't mean that you say, okay, lols, never mind. But the work of a lifetime is, you know, as my dad used to say, resentment is like drinking poison and hoping that the other guy dies.
Mm. Oh, and she says something like that too.
Now you're trolling me with Marianne Williamson. But there's nothing more important than we can do. And if you think about somebody like Schultz, whose father viciously beat the scene in the shower where the dad, you know, rips him out of the shower, beating him. Who could forgive a father who did that? Who could forgive anyone who did that? But in fact, as we come to see the shared humanity that we all have, that we can finally let that melt. And letting that melt makes special. Makes it better.
Okay, Kathleen in 19, she asked this, what is the limit on how far back we can go to find unwise youthful indiscretions to use to ruin lives and reputations? Great question, Kathleen.
Well, and by the way, if these Republicans who are injudiciously saying, yeah, what do you think now, Mr. Blackface, Mr. You were at a college party, blah, 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 blah. Like, so what you're saying now is that you want the Kavanaugh standard to be applied to everybody. You don't want to say, because the judicious but also humane thing would be for Republicans to now stand up for Mark Herring and say of the Virginia Attorney General, hey, look, this is not cool. This blackface, we did not – in 1980, Americans – I was five, so I think I'm safe. But Americans did not understand – white America did not grasp the painful legacy of minstrel shows and blackface in the way that we do now. And there was a difference, and that teenagers are dumb. And that as a teenager – and Curtis Blow – shout out again, but that he wanted to look like Curtis Blow and go to go do a performance like that, and that this would be a terminal event in his public life is crazy cakes. That's crazy talk. And Republicans know it. Many Republicans know it, and they ought to say it. And it would serve them better in the long run to do it than go, well, you said Kavanaugh, so now you must die. Because it, there was a guy, I don't know whether you know it, he was the 43rd president of the United States, and he reminded us that if we hold to the he reminded us of Martin Luther King, who told us that if we apply the law of an eye for an eye, we all end up blind.
Another question here is, what do you make of Camp Pendleton voting for the Democrat? What is he talking about? This is from Rihanna. What happened at Camp Pendleton?
I'm not sure.
I have no idea. But you know what? We'll check it out and get back to you.
We'll check.
We probably won't, but we will think about it.
Well, I would say that the military vote is the president ought to be careful, and he ought to be sure that he is keeping faith with these military voters. Who don't like it when things get weird.
Okay. Chad Ingalls wants to know, he's heading to D.C. in a couple weeks. What's a couple of restaurant recommendations for a few, I'll tell you what, Iowa farmers?
Well, that's such a, I love that question, of course.
I'm going to make a recommendation.
Hit it.
What's that, the restaurant that has, that's the year?
1789?
Yes. Good idea.
Those better be some prosperous Iowa farmers.
Well,
1789 is to maintain a, to be a restaurant, especially serving French food, and maintain at this level for this number of years is a pretty remarkable thing. And it is.
Okay. So there's one. Now you give one.
I'm going to say, I've seen, I always wrestle with this because I don't know if I want to give restaurants I'd like to go to because I'm afraid more people will go and then it'll be harder for me to get a table. But I am going to say that a cool, fun place to go is, that's a little off, I want to be a little, not too by the book. I'm going to say that they should go to, I'll just say it, go to Aqua Aldo. It's the word aqua and then A-L and then the numeral 2. And it is my favorite restaurant in Washington, and it is the best Italian restaurant in Washington. And the food is amazing, and the steak is amazing, and everything is amazing. And it's just great. And it feels very homey, and it's just great. And it's true. And now I won't be able to get tables on Sundays anymore, but that's fine.
This is basically a question that everybody is asking, which is... Let's just use H.L. Thatcher's. What was your initial thoughts on Dana's queso? What a thing, huh?
What is it like? Okay, so I got to – this is the first time I got to see – because I think you – did you text me the picture before you tweeted it?
I texted it to you, and then I tweeted it, like, right after.
Yeah. So I got to watch – I got to watch the tragedy unfold.
Me, you wrote back. You said, you didn't post that, did you? And that's when I knew, oh, no. But I didn't know anything about foodie Twitter. I didn't know what it was like for a tweet to go viral. I didn't know about memes. I learned a lot.
You did,
and I also am not cooking ever again. I'm done.
Well, wait a minute. Wait. Okay, so first it was.
I mean, I'm not sad. I'm laughing about the whole thing. I really just want to be asked to bring wine from now on to all places.
Frankly, it was awesome. And I think. Okay, but
I have made better queso. I have.
I'm sure, and that just the skin got too thick on top. But from a distance, getting to watch from. My friend is at my other friend's house for the Super Bowl party, and she made queso. And it's like, Dana, put a lid on that. Oh, my
gosh. And how bad is it that I took it to Jenny Lander's house, and she's like the best cook we know.
Exactly. To get to watch it unfold, and then it goes from Dana Twitter to – and then somebody in your Twitter universe drags it over to foodie Twitter. And then in foodie Twitter, it gets taken into comedy Twitter, and Paul Tompkins and others light it up, and it becomes this huge thing. Getting to watch that unfold while I'm sitting there eating chicken wings and watching the second half of the Super Bowl. Watching the worst Super Bowl, Boo Patriots. Watching all of that unfold in real time was like – I felt like I was watching an ant farm take place.
I didn't know all of it that happened until the next morning when I woke up, and then my producers were like, that is the funniest thing that's ever happened.
One.
And Hamda said, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me on a Monday morning. I'm like, what are you talking about?
What was your favorite meme?
I lost track. There were so many good ones, but there was a guy that put out he posted a picture of a burnt piece of toast.
That's my favorite.
And he said, I made nachos.
I made nachos.
that explained to me how bad people thought it was. But then I did an interview with Houston Chronicle. The thing is that all this stuff got messed up because I won a queso contest 2 years ago against Porter Berry, who runs FoxNews.com.
Yeah, but he makes Oklahoma queso.
Right. That's why I won, and I used this other recipe. And then we talked about it on the podcast, and then everybody wanted me to post the recipe. So I did. So people think that's the queso that I made the other night that turned into the meme, but it wasn't. The queso I made the other night was one I got off the internet that said, oh, if you want to make a queso that's like the one from Chili's restaurant, this is how you do it. So that's what I made. And then
did it have sausage and?
No, it just had chili, no beans.
Like beef. It had like meat.
Well, it's like one 15-ounce can of chili, no beans.
It had canned meat in it?
Well, how else are you supposed
saying,
how else are you
saying,
supposed to
Are you saying that that chili that I have I have low key defended to people? Are you saying that it had canned meat in it?
Well, it said chili.
I take it all back. I take all my defenses back.
Well, Chili's restaurant defended me.
You cannot serve people dog food. You cannot serve people dog food.
It wasn't dog food. It was chili with no beans.
Canned meat.
Well, how else are you supposed to make chili no beans for a queso that you're supposed to cook in a crock pot?
Canned meat.
You're supposed to like make your own meat?
It's over. My favorite, other than I made nachos, which was so good, was crying Jordan in the center of the crock pot. And I thought that was like the nice fin de siècle on it. But I haven't talked to my sister Jenny about this yet. But if you truly try to give up completely, I may sick Jenny on you.
Let's just talk about this. I made the stuffed mushrooms that she recommended. They were good, but I burned my finger so badly and it peeled for a month. Mm-hmm. Then I made that chicken crock pot thing the other day and it was disgusting. And obviously I need to get away from the crock pot. But here's the other thing. It's just not – I don't have the time. And I am not going to – I'm just not going to pretend that I have the ability and time to do this. Oh, you should have seen me. I was so ambitious. Steve Doocy's cookbook has in it my queso recipe from 2016, not this past Sunday.
Is buffalo, it a keto cookbook?
No.
Okay.
No. Buffalo chicken egg rolls.
Whoa.
Okay. Now, Peter would love that so much. And
yes.
I'm like, oh, I should make this for him. He would love it so much. And it looks – I'm like, that's pretty ambitious. So I texted Steve Doocy And he said, he writes back, he's like, new phone, who this? I'm like, it's Dana. And he's like, oh, no, it's fine. And he sends me a YouTube video I'm supposed to watch so that I can understand how to do the wontons. And I'm like, forget it. So then I went back to the crock pot.
So Jenny's selection of Lacey mushroom caps for you to make is that it is a simple and delicious dish that you can feel confident that people will enjoy. It's fairly delicate. It feels fairly sophisticated, but it's pretty straightforward. And once you get the hang of it, I would just say that for you, some people, everybody has a different love language, but I sound like Marianne Williamson, but I would say that one of the most effective ways to express love for your fellow human is to make them something good to eat.
Right. And, so I was thinking about that.
And so I would say, instead of closing the door completely, maybe you would succeed if you had just one or two things that were your go-tos. And that it's like after my mom stopped cooking at whatever age, she was like, I'm done. I've cooked enough for you people. She was a world's great cook. She was a truly fantastic cook. But about the time I was 12, it was like, we're going out. I've cooked enough. But she still had a couple few things that she knew that she was going to go to do that she could make and have. And I would just say that maybe that's the solution here.
Okay. In the 2 minutes we have remaining before we do your trivia, I just have to tell you a very special story. I'm not going to reveal the names. But just so that everybody knows that sometimes good news happens and it can happen often. It can happen very quickly. Yesterday I was in Washington, D.C. for the State of the Union, and I had an hour's break between the ending of the daily briefing and the beginning of the five. So I went and visited a girlfriend of mine who she and her husband, she used to work with us at the White House. Then she's had lots of other jobs in Washington, and she's like the first young woman I ever actually mentored. And she succeeded wonderfully. And then she and her husband have been trying to adopt a baby for, I think, 5 years.
Okay.
And so they were with this looking, lots of prayer. And I remember I saw her last April, 2018, how everything's going. I asked so sort of gently, and she's like, if we're just not getting any feedback, and like we maybe have to go a different direction with a different adoption agency or whatever. But fast forward. So I did that Minute Mentoring event 2 weeks ago in D.C. The week before that, I had sent her a text on a Friday night. So I said, hey, can you come to this Minute Mentoring event and be one of the mentors and help me out and volunteer that night? And she writes back, I would love to, except we just got a call.
Hey.
Are told to be on an airplane to get to Atlanta by tomorrow morning.
Hey.
And so I got to go see this new baby born just a few weeks ago. Tiny baby. They actually let me hold it, believe it or not. Pinkest baby I've ever seen. Pink. With little red hair. And, I think the mother and father, I think, made a really good choice in choosing this family. And they just didn't think they were able to provide for this little baby and this little girl. And my friends are. And it is a spectacular story of all of it. Like all the good stuff, all the good ingredients go into this.
Have you ever heard the expression, don't give up before the miracle?
Yeah. I heard it on the podcast. And I'm not joking.
It's true. It's true that when you're engaged in the struggle and it's hard, and do I really want to keep doing this? And do I really want to stay after this? Is this worth it? Is that wouldn't the worst thought be? And of course, we all got to know when to cut our losses. And there's the unfixable bucket in life, and some things have to go in the unfixable bucket, and we lament those things, and that's what mourning is for. But on other things, the worst idea is that you were so close that if a day earlier, if that family had said, we're done, we're withdrawing our applications, we're out, that they would have given up just before the miracle. And that's the worst thought. And for people of faith especially, it's like, how long do I have to stay here? How long do I have to keep working in this little salt mine that I've found myself in? And sometimes the answer is until you want to.
Don't give up before the miracle.
Word.
I think that's our headline. All right, you ready for your trivia?
Ready.
I'll give you the date and city of death. You give me the president.
Oh, I like these.
You give me the president. September 14th, 1901, Buffalo, New York.
McKinley.
January 5th, 1933, Northampton, Massachusetts.
Coolidge.
Yes. April 22nd, 1994, New York City.
April 22nd, 1994.
I would have known this one.
1994.
I was visiting the college I was going to go to for graduate school with my dad.
1994, a president who died in 1994. See, because when Nixon, until Nixon left office, there was a period of time where there were no living former presidents. So we reboot in New York, Gerald Ford?
Richard Nixon.
No. Oh, yeah, he did die in New York.
October 8th, 1869.
Concord, New Hampshire. Who would die? Who would have the temerity to die in 1869 in Concord, New Hampshire? Franklin Pierce died much sooner than that, I think. Right. No, I'm saying it's not Franklin Pierce.
It is Franklin Pierce.
Oh, it is. Well, I knew it was Franklin Pierce the whole time.
There you go.
I thought he was so miserable he would have died sooner.
March 28th, 1969, Washington, D.C.
That is 69 was Ike.
Yep. Dwight Eisenhower. Very good. Very good.
Did I get them all? Did I get them? No, I missed one. I missed Nixon.
Well, we'll give you Franklin Pierce. I mean, because we are expressing love.
There we go.
Yes. We're not giving him Nixon? Oh, no. We're not giving you Nixon.
We're not giving him. So I missed two. Nixon and
but we still love you because we have to love. This is love and love. Just keep giving out love and love.
Transcendent
and
love. Yes, ma'am.
This is the thing. This is the thing. All right.
And queso.
For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this one on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a review. This has been Perino and Starwalt. I'll tell you what on Fox News.